Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, your home for deer hunting news, stories, and strategies. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kenyon, and this is episode number 226. And today in the show, I'm joined by Brad Ferris, a Mississippi bow hunter, a member of the Primos hunting team, and a Whitetail Properties land specialist. Alright, before we get into the show, we need to thank Lacrosse Boots for their support of this episode of the podcast. And Lacrosse is an easy company for me to talk about here on the podcast because I've personally been using their product for coming up on 2 decades now. So, you know, it's not a stretch at all for me to recommend them to you. I actually remember my Uncle Bill was the first one to show up at our family deer camp wearing his green and yellow Lacrosse rubber boots. And after seeing them and him telling us how much he liked them, you know, my dad and I soon went out and got our own for that next season. So ever since then, I've been using various models that they put out. Most recently, I've been wearing their Arrowhead boots, and this year I'll be trying their new Alpha Burley Pros. So I'll keep you all posted on what I think about the new pair, but based on all my past experiences, I'm confident that just like all those previous models, these are going to be fully waterproof, they're going to be warm, they're going to be comfortable to hike around in, and all of that with the added benefit of being pretty darn scent-free given that rubber outer construction. So I'm excited about that, and if you'd like to learn more about Lacrosse for yourself, you can visit lacrossefootwear.com. And now, welcome to the Wired Hunt Podcast, brought to you by Onyx. And today in the show, I'm joined by Brad Ferris, and I think for a lot of folks, Brad's a household name in the hunting world because of his long-running work with Primos. He's been a consistent face there on their TV shows and videos for many years now, and that's something that Brad does continue to do today, but he's also a Whitetail Properties land specialist and a Level 2 QDMA deer steward, which is a certification program that the Quality Deer Management Association runs, which basically it means that if you've made it to level 2, you've been through one of the most comprehensive whitetail biology and management programs available. So I say all this just to make sure it's clear that what we've got here is a tremendous resource. Brad is a wealth of information. And I was excited to have him on the show, not because of just all that, but also because he hails from the South. And as I've freely admitted in the past, and as some of you have, you've made sure that I don't forget, I've not always done a good job of featuring guests from that part of the country. So I'm glad that at least for this week, I can right that wrong. And now, after speaking with Brad, I'm even more excited about it because, you know, he's just a genuinely interesting person and generous guy with his insight and excitement and passion about white-tailed deer. So in this one, we chat with Brad a bit about his background growing up hunting in Mississippi and what that tradition is like down there. We talk through some of the different ways that hunting deer in the South can be uniquely challenging and different ways to address those challenges. We talk through things like hunting clubs, sharing or buying property with a group of people, sharing property with friends, that kind of stuff. We talk through tips for hunting and scouting river bottoms. We discuss the southern rut and just a whole lot more like that. We really dive into a lot of different facets of how Brad has found success, not just in the South, but across the country too. So I think it's going to be one of those episodes that I think we're all going to enjoy a lot. I'm excited for you to hear it. We don't have Dan with us today for the pregame show, so we're going to be able to get right into the episode here in just a second. But I do want to give a couple quick little plugs since we have a touch of extra time here. And the first thing here is that way back on episode 218 of the podcast, my buddy Andy May was on the show with us, you might remember. And during that conversation, he shared some thoughts and ideas for dealing with target panic. We got a lot of great feedback on that. People had more questions. People wanted to see some things. So what me and Andy decided to do was actually put together a couple videos that better explain and illustrate some of the concepts that he discussed. So if you're interested in that, those videos are now out there on the Wired Hunt YouTube channel. We've got one where Andy's explaining, you know, what target panic is and how to diagnose it. We have another video where we show ways to eliminate target panic by using an unanticipated release and how you can achieve that with a number of different different actual releases. So index finger release, a hinge style release, a thumb button release. And then there'll be a video coming out here. It should be out by the time you're listening to this, which goes through some drills that you can use while you're practicing at home to really hammer all this stuff. So definitely check out those videos if you're interested in that concept, that issue. And we've got many other weekly video blogs that I've been posting over there, all on the Wired Hunt YouTube channel. So if you're not subscribed to that, please do so. Because again, this fall, there's going to be a lot of content on there. I'm going to be getting some more help on the video side of things, which is something I've been needing for a while. And I think that's going to lead to much better content. So I'm excited about that. And next, we need to take a quick second to thank Onyx for their support of this podcast. And the Onyx Hunt app is something that, you know, similarly to what I mentioned a little while ago, it's easy for me to talk about because it's something that I've personally been using for quite a number of years now. And the Onyx Hunt app, it provides me digital maps right on my phone. And with the Elite membership, which is something I bought last year, it gives me access to property owner information and public land borders and all sorts of other helpful map layers for the entire country. You can go in there and select whatever states, up to 5 states at a time, where you want this in-depth information. And it's funny, just last night, I was using my Onyx app because my buddy Furter, he was telling me about this new property that he might be getting permission to hunt on. And it's actually kind of near my main southern Michigan farm that I hunt. So I was kind of excited to hear about that. And I wanted to check out the aerial of the property. I wanted to see what this place looked like. But he was driving. And he didn't really know how to describe to me where it was at other than the road name and then the last name of the property owner. So he told me he'd send me a screenshot later when he got done driving. But I'm an impatient person. So I pulled up my Onyx app last night. I started slowly panning along this road he mentioned. And I was just looking at all the property owner names and trying to match up to find this place he's talking about hunting. And I kept going until I actually found the place, was able to see the parcel boundaries, was able to see the aerial view of the place. I could see the topo lines. I could see, you know, I could see the swamps. I could see the crop fields and the timber and everything like that. Basically everything I needed to analyze the property and be able to say, hey, yeah, Furter, you should try to hunt this place. Definitely try and nail down that permission because it looks pretty nice. So I'm hoping that works out because, you know, not only would I like Josh to have a nice place to hunt, but it would be selfishly nice for me to have him hunting close here because if all the stars align, I'm hoping he will be close enough to swing on over and help me drag Holyfield out of the woods one of these nights. So we'll see. I digress, though. I guess my point here is that I'm personally finding the Onyx Hunt app to be a very handy tool. And if you'd like to check it out for yourself, you can visit onyxmaps.com or head to the mobile phone app store of your choice. And now, let's get this show on the road. All right, with me now on the line is Brad Ferris. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to come visit with you and talk to things that we all enjoy, which is obviously white-tailed deer and all portions of it.
Yes. Yeah. I've never had a bad day when I get to talk about deer hunting. That just, it's always a good thing. So, I understand you've been pretty busy lately though. How are you doing?
Well, we're doing good. You know, I still do a lot of work with Primos Hunting. I started working there, I guess, in the mid-90s, and I don't have any day-to-day work there as I used to do, because now with Whitetail Properties, you know, just selling land and farms and hunting land is my everyday job. But I still work on the TV show with Will, Jimmy, and myself, and the other Primos guys, Troy, Lake, and Jordan. So still get to do some of the fun stuff with those guys and talk hunting property every day. So that's kind of my daily routine now.
Yeah, that is not a bad day-to-day routine right there. I think a lot of guys would love that. What
look, I've been so fortunate and blessed. I pinch myself every morning to be sure it's a true day.
Yeah. It's funny. It's easy. I don't know if you're like this too, but sometimes it's easy for me to fall into, like, you know, stuff just becomes work eventually, right? No matter how unique or cool it is, eventually it does become work, and you find yourself waking up in the morning like, oh man, I got this thing to do and that thing to do and that thing to do. And then I always need to catch myself, just like you said, I need to pinch myself and say, hey, the stuff that you have to do, you get to hop on a phone and talk about deer. You get to run outside and take some pictures or check a trail camera and share that online. Like my work is so blessed, right, to be able to do that. So yeah, I have to always remind myself that we've got to really good and need to be thankful for that, right?
Every day, very fortunate. Look, I've got to spend so much time in the outdoors, and I tell people it's funny. I didn't even see a dogwood tree bloom until I was about 25 years old. I'm 49 now. And meaning that, you know, a dogwood tree blooming in the spring, I would just walk by it and never realize what a great thing it is. As I got older, you started seeing that thing, and the little things like that started in nature started meaning more to me as a outdoors person than anything, you know. And I guess I kind of take that from what you said. It's those little blessings that we have each and every day we got to be thankful for.
Yeah, very true. So rewinding real quick right to what you're saying a second ago, I just want to get a little bit better idea of what your world looks like right now. Like you said, you're continuing to contribute on the TV shows with Primos, but on the Whitetail Property side, where are you operating? You know, it sounds like around Mississippi, that general area. Can you tell us a little more about what you're focused on down there and what you're finding?
Sure. So Chipper Gibbs, he's my full-time partner with Whitetail Properties, and he and I are licensed in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas. And, you know, our focus every day is recreational land, farmland, timberland. And, I mean, we have properties that we sell two people and four people from 40 acres to, I mean, I got one property right now that's 9,800 acres. So we handle all things recreation, timber, and farm. And that's what we do every day. Now, as far as houses go, I mean, I can sell a house just like anybody, but that's not what we do. Our focus is on land and farm and, you know, ranch, timber type stuff, just recreational style focus. So, yeah, we do that in these three states down here. And I've helped some guys on some elk ranches out west as well. Cause as long as you have a real estate license, you know, you can work anywhere with a licensed person in that area. So every day just wake up thinking about, you know, hunting land and just trying to make people's dreams come true, because we're responsible for people really, really lean on us to help them make a purchase of a lifetime.
Yeah.
And I take that very seriously and not lightly, because misguiding somebody would not be something that I would ever do.
Yeah. So. You mentioned you've got a 9,800 acre property for sale. It's mm-hmm. just happenstance. I think I ran across this property. Is this the Brandywine Island?
It is. It's Brandywine. It's actually even in two states. It's in Arkansas and Tennessee. Another Whitetail agent, David Pritchard, and I have it listed for the owners. And it is a truly magnificent piece of property. It's just been protected for so many years, and it's like something you would have seen, you know, 30 years ago. It's just that been preserved that much.
Yeah.
And it is one incredible deer property, duck and turkey track as well.
Yeah, I've been watching a bunch of the different Primos YouTube videos lately, and there's an old one where you guys are hunting this place called Brandywine Island. And so I was watching that, and I'm like, man, this place looks pretty wild. So I just Googled Brandywine Island to try to figure out where this is, and then I saw, oh, it's actually an individual property that is actually being sold right now. So I ended up looking at the listing, and wow, that looks like a absolute dream location. Yeah, that's pretty awesome. So it's kind of funny you mentioned that.
It is great. It's just a big place. You don't see that many single owned properties. Been in that family for like I said, 30 years. And the man that purchased it passed away, and his wife, still the owner now. And she's in her 80s, and she's just kind of ready to pass it on to the next guy.
Yeah.
And I wish I was that next guy. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah. Wow. So let's talk about that general area down there. I mean, if I understand right, you grew up hunting in Mississippi, is that right?
That is correct. Yeah, I grew up in Jackson, Mississippi. I live in a little small town outside of Jackson now called Raymond, and been here my whole life. And we have a place that I hunt on the Mississippi River. It's called Togo Island, that we turned it into a share club, and that's kind of got to be a big thing down here in the South and even in other parts of the country. Where, let me explain what a share club is, where guys go in, and so it's 12 of us own Togo. You have undivided interest. I bought a share, and other guys, we went in and put this together, and we have rules just like a hunting camp, but you take a big property like that, it's very few people can buy it on their own. So it's been done enough and been somewhat perfected where it just really, really works great. Because our place is 7,200 acres, which is extremely big for a southern property. But you can imagine one guy biting that bullet, that's a pretty big step. But you get, 10 or 12 guys, and it's really an unattainable position for most people.
Yeah.
And it's just a deer factory down there.
That's one of the things that seems very unique compared to like where I'm hunting up in Michigan. It seems like down in the southern part of the U.S. there's a lot of these hunting clubs, or sounds like a share club where you actually share property. That's something I've never experienced, where you might share property with that many people that all know each other and are kind of working together a little bit. What's that like, sharing a property like that with people that are all kind of have a vested interest in it? Anything that you have to uniquely think about when planning your hunts, or when actually figuring out management plans, or if someone was going to get into something like this themselves that they should be aware of before diving in?
Yeah, and it's really easy to do. So you take yourself and four buddies up in your part of the country, and say you wanted to, and it's 1,000 acres in the South, to me, is not near as big as 1,000 acres, say, in the Midwest. It hunts different here. You need more land here to manage deer herds to a mature age than I think you do in the Midwest. But the biggest thing is you got to have an operating agreement. You got to put that together. You got to have a set of rules. And, it's not like owning your own place. You do have to have rules to go by, and everybody has to adhere to them. Like, we have a board of managers that makes the day-to-day decision on how we operate. We pay a yearly dues that operates the club, pays, for the food plots, pays for the equipment, and just the day-to-day operation. The biggest thing I would tell somebody starting one, the people are the key to it. You get 10 good people, we really have a good time, and we have as much fun after the hunt, around the fire pit, around eating time or supper time as we do hunting. So the biggest thing is finding people that can get along with each other. We do not sell a share to anybody unless they come spend a couple weekends hunting with us. And, we want them to like us as well. So it's just instead of just taking somebody with a check, we want to get to know them before we let them in the, as a partner. And we feel like it's important that they get to know us.
Yeah.
And it can really work good. It just takes some time and effort, but it's a great way for four or five or six people to go in and buy a nice sized property and be able to afford it and manage it.
So this is something I was just going to say this is something I've thought about a lot, you know, going in on a property with a group of friends, because to your point, it can be hard to afford a big property on your own. But if you get a group together, pool your money, share the place. But then at the same time, there's always that lingering worry in the back, you know, what if someone can't pull their own, or what if something goes wrong handful of years into it? Like, is there anything, if you're actually going to buy into a place like this with friends, from, you know, being a realtor yourself, like from the actual setting up the purchase agreement or how you set that up or any kind of safety mechanisms that you put in place to make sure you're protected if someone goes off the deep end or if someone all of a sudden can't pay their share anymore or anything on that front? Like if we're actually going to buy property with a couple friends or something that we should be thinking about?
Well, so the way most of them are set up is you have like a company, say like a land company. And the way we do ours is you can buy into the land company, but that does not give you rights, recreational rights on the property, meaning you own a part of that as an investment. You know, we could never take that away from you, but we have it set up where if somebody falls off the deep end for whatever, 5 years from now, you know, gets in trouble, whatever that may be, we can actually force them out of the recreational rights. It's in the operating agreement that they signed from day one. Now we can't, all we can do is buy them out of the company side of it. But we do have checks and balances set up to actually, you know, remove somebody from the recreational side in case that happens. And unfortunately that's the unfun part of it, but that's something that has to be done to protect everybody's interest.
Yeah.
It's just a simple operating agreement that an attorney can do. And, yeah, but it definitely has to be there because, you know, things change. 10 years from now is a long time. You just don't never know what could happen.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems smart to make sure you've got the paperwork, kind of have that operating agreement, everything figured out ahead of time. It's easy, I think, for some people, especially if you're friends, you know, just like, oh, let's just shake our hands and say we're going to do this and just go ahead with it. But to your point, things change. You never know what might come up.
You never know. And you have to, I guess the easiest way to explain it, it's a business and you have to treat it like a business and set it up as a business. And if you do that, it works good. I mean, I can't tell you how proud I am to be a part of Togo and be able to recreate there year round. And I'm headed there next week to get on a bulldozer and redo some food plots and make some new food plots all week. So
awesome. That's
actually more fun to me than the rut.
Yeah.
Crazy as that sounds.
No, I do know that's fun. I in a second, I'm going to want to ask you a little more about what you guys are doing there specifically, but I want to jump a little bit back towards just hunting clubs in general, because I understand there's a lot of clubs out there where folks don't actually own the land together, but they, you know, maybe 20 guys all hunt this chunk that maybe is leased from a, you know, timber company or something like that.
Right. So
I've heard, you know, people mention this kind of stuff, but again, I've never done it. But I hear stories of having to sign up for a specific tree stand each day or different things along those lines. Is there anything you've heard or have found as far as how to just, you know, that just seems like it'd be a little bit difficult when you don't actually get to choose where you want to hunt on a given day. You know, usually I'm making a decision based off of, you know, information I have, weather conditions, wind conditions, access routes, all these different things, trail camera data that are going to tell me where I need to be on this given day. But if I had to then, if I knew where I wanted to be, but then I have to, you know, hopefully no one's already there kind of situation or sign up the day before, that seems like it'd throw a wrench in it sometimes. How do you recommend people handle or make the best of those types of situations?
You know, I hunted that, and of course I know what you're saying. You have trail cameras and you have places you want to hunt, and you know, you wait on a perfect wind, but that is the thing about a hunting club, even a share club, that you got to be able to deal with is just to, I kind of say, you got to play with others, so to speak, and have some patience. That is the part of it. You know, you're not there on your own. It ain't like you own your own 400 or 500 acres and you can set up 10 spots and hunt them when you want. You know, that's the ideal situation. But for many of us, you know, hardworking folks that can afford that, you have to get in a hunting club that, say, a timber company owns, and you lease, say, 2,500 acres, and it's 25 people. You know, and all of them are set up different. Some clubs have it where everybody's got their own little spots, and that's where they go day in and day out. And others have a sign-in board where you draw, which this kind of works good, where you draw, say, if it's 10 of us, and you put your hand in a hat and you draw 1 through 10, well, whoever draws 1 obviously has first pick that morning or that afternoon, and then whoever draws 10 has last pick. So that's the part of a hunting club that you have to be able to deal with as well. And that's kind of – deer camp's a big thing down in the South. A lot of deer camps. But they work really good. I mean, there's going to always be some issues, but they usually don't take people long to weed those bad apples out. And some people just need to hunt their own place and hunt it the way they want. I guess when I'm primos hunting, we are serious and we hunt really hard. But when I'm fun hunting, I don't get too worried about being so serious. I just like to have fun and appreciate the time outside.
Yeah. You mentioned there's a lot of deer camps. That's a big thing for you guys down there. It seems like there's a really rich tradition down in the Southern deer hunting tradition. It seems to be a really unique, really special thing. Can you talk about that a little bit? What makes that so special?
You know, when I grew up in a deer camp in Jasper County, which is in the eastern side of Mississippi, and this, I think one reason there's so many camps like that is because there is a lot of timber company. You know, timber's a big thing here, and it's a lot of companies that own large tracts of land, and they lease out portions of it to certain clubs, and that's just kind of been that way for years. And that's from east to west, all over the state of Mississippi, Alabama, and even Louisiana too, the same. It's definitely important. Gosh, I can remember as a kid, could not wait to go to deer camp on Friday night. That was like what I lived for. I quit all of sports in the seventh grade because they started interfering with my deer camp time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that was just the most important thing to me, was going to deer camp on Friday night and hunting till Sunday till Sunday afternoon. And I know many people share that same way of thinking and doing this day and time.
Yeah. Yeah. We kind of have a similar thing up in Northern Michigan. We've got our Northern Michigan deer camps and little cabin up in the big woods. And, you know, one of the things that we always used to do up there that later in life, I found out that some people don't do, and they kind of thought was bizarre. But we have like buck poles is this thing up there where, you know, mm-hmm. opening weekend of gun season or whatever, everyone, you know, gets your buck and you hang them on these poles, and even like gas stations and, you know, grocery stores and stuff will have these big poles out in the parking lot, and everyone brings their deer there and everyone hangs their deer. And then you know, folks mill around all night looking at the deer and talking about telling your stories and everything like that. That just seemed to be mm-hmm. like what you just did. And that was like the coolest thing. But then as an adult later, I talked to people down in, you know, Kentucky or Iowa or wherever. And they're like, you do what? You hang all these deer on a pole? They thought it was kind of bizarre seeing these pictures of 10 deer or 20 deer all lined up like that. Is there anything unique mm-hmm. like that? Or anything unique to a Southern deer camp that you guys do that maybe we'd see up here and be like, oh, that's kind of different?
You know, nothing like that, like in a community where you take and hang your deer up. But I know at every hunting club, we call them skin and sheds. You know, the skin and shed, like at Cottonmouth, where we do all our primo stuff, the skin and shed is kind of like the center place where we always congregate and we meet at. We can't wait to get to late morning and then right after dark to see what happens. So our skin and shed, so to speak, is kind of our fun place as a group where we get together and do what you just discussed. But it's, you know, it's just within our group. It's not in a, like in a public in town or anything like that.
Gotcha.
So yeah, skin and shed is an important part of deer camp. Very fun. Yeah. Where all the laughs and stories are told.
Yeah, the social hub. That is an important part.
Yes, that's a good way.
Yeah. You talked a little bit ago about how 1,000 acres down there doesn't seem to hunt as big as 1,000 acres in the Midwest, maybe. Can you expand on that? I'm kind of curious because again, I haven't hunted down south. I'm always trying to better understand what makes it unique down there. What's unique about that situation? Why do you think that is?
You know, and we have a lot of the deer numbers. We have a lot of deer numbers here. I spent a lot of time hunting in Iowa, Illinois, Kansas, you know, years ago. And, you know, a 500-acre farm, say in Illinois, it just, it's kind of hard to explain. You a mature deer, so a 5.5-year-old deer down here, in my experience, does not move like a 5.5-year-old deer in the Midwest. You know, I can remember seeing, just say, 160-inch 5 or 6-year-old deer and hunting him in Illinois and seeing him move every day and trying to figure him out. Here, you have like the first few days of the season, if they're on some kind of summer pattern, you have, you know, you might have an opportunity at one of those kind of deer. If not, chances are you're going to have to wait till the rut, you know, before or during the rut to catch them moving. They just don't move here typically like they do up there. And a lot of it too is food, because, you know, late season in your part of the world, if you got some kind of food source established, you're going to see some deer. I mean, they're going to move. We don't really have winter kill here. We don't have extreme cold temperatures that make those deer move. So, you know, you really, really rut time is when things happen here on those really top end deer. Now, backing that up, how does that change? I mean, it's some similarities in the Midwest versus the South, but it just hunts different. How can I put that into words where people listening can understand that? You know, a lot of our stuff is thick. Like on our place that we own, and like many other people, to me, cover is the most important thing you can have. I mean, I know everybody has, you know, all these attractants and feed and makes food plots, and that's a huge part of hunting. But I look at cover before I look at anything, because if I got plenty of cover, I'm going to have plenty of mature deer. If you only got one, say I got a 200-acre block, and this is kind of nuts and bolts of what I enjoy doing most, is you got a 200-acre block of land and you got like a 40-acre clear cut in the middle of it and the rest is open timber, yeah, you're going to have some deer in that 40 acres to keep it a sanctuary. But if you take that same 200 acres and you make 4 10-acre bedding areas, clear cuts or heavy thinnings on that 200 acres, you're going to hold more mature deer, in my opinion, because they can spread out. I mean, yeah, they're fine this time of year hanging out together, but once that velvet comes off, they turn into different, you know, different animals, and you need to give them plenty of space to spread out.
Yeah. Could you run through a little hypothetical with me here? I'm curious. Yeah. Cause I love the same thing that you're talking about here, where I love the ability to kind of paint whatever picture you want on a piece of property, kind of do things like that to try to make it better for wildlife, better for hunting. I don't own any land, so I've had very limited opportunities, but I've been able to do this on a couple little spots. But let's say you've got that situation, that 200-acre block of timber, and let's say you own it and you can do whatever you want with it to try to make it into a better piece of whitetail ground. Let's say it's down in Mississippi, it's open timber, but you've got, you know, the ability to do some stuff. Can you walk us through this hypothetical 200-acre property and how you'd approach turning it from just a big block of timber into something you think would be an ideal whitetail setup?
Sure. It seemed like I do this daily, because it's a big part of what we do at Whitetail Properties, explaining stuff to people and helping them. This is one way I like to think about it and explain it. The uglier a piece of property is, the better hunting it is 9 times out of 10. Meaning, if it's been cut and it's briars and it's nasty and it's thick, I mean, that is the perfect habitat, the perfect place for whitetail deer. That's what they love. If you walk out there and it's open trees and beautiful, you know, you got a lot more timber value actually, but you just don't have the cover and the sanctuary for those deer. They just deer want thick stuff here. I've seen deer in the Midwest, I mean, bucks just bed on the side of an open ridge. You don't hardly ever find that down here, deer bedded up. Now, he might be if a tree fell from a storm or a top, he might be laying in that every now and then, but they just, they don't stay in that open country. They're going to find that sanctuary every time, does, bucks, young and old. So how would you set up that? So if you can, if you have the opportunity to make those deer sleep where you want them and eat where you want them, as in a food plot, food source for summer or winter, to me, that is ideal. And if you set it up with a southerly section and a northerly section, meaning, you know, if you got south winds, you got these, this area you can hunt. And if you got north winds, you got this area you can hunt. And just draw it out where if you go in and you cut timber and it gets thick, they will be there without question. They will be there. And then if you leave some open timber in between that and say a 2 to 5 acre food plot, well, you just created a transition area that, whether it's, you know, from feed to bed or from bed to feed, you have the ability to get in there and actually hang stands and hunt those deer and make them somewhat move in a pattern that you control. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
To you. And then it takes 3 to 5 years to create that in some instances, but once you get it done, it can be so much fun. And not only do you create that and it gives them a safe place to be, but it also gives you got to remember access, you know, getting into those spots and getting out of those spots. That's as important as anything, especially getting out in the afternoon. You know, if you got to blow your deer out of a food plot every afternoon, you're putting pressure on them, and that's fine. You're going to see deer, but those older deer just don't put up with it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in the beginning about how, you know, rather than having your property with like a big 40 acre cut in the middle, you'd rather have 4 10-acre cuts. So you've, like you said, spread them out a little bit. When you're setting you're setting up these food plots, you're carving in these food plots too. In this scenario, if we're trying to look at like the ideal, would you then try to pair a small food plot with each one of those bedding areas too, or would you have
absolutely.
Just the one big? Yeah, what would you do there?
No, that's, and maybe I didn't explain myself, but yeah, I would create a food plot and a bedding area at each of those 4 locations.
Gotcha.
And maybe have a couple more, just depending on every place is a little different. Yeah, definitely you would need to create that. And that's why I say you got 4, so you got 2 you can hunt on a south southerly flow pattern. And then you got 2 that you can hunt on a northerly, you know, flow pattern with the winds.
Yep.
That's exactly right. Just, you know, and that's just a little scenario. It could be much bigger than that, obviously. Now, I do like big food plots. You know, you can have the bigger the food plot, the more deer are going to use it. And I love having a big food plot that I call a destination plot on a track too, if possible, because if a small one, you might feed, let's just say 2 to 5 deer that live in that section of your farm. If you have a big one, you're going to have deer come from all sections of that farm as a nighttime thing. That's why when you have fields and you walk in those fields, you're like, man, look at the rubs and the scrapes and the deer sign. That's because these deer, that's where they go and spend their nights. You know, that's where they stay and they spend time there. That's why you have so much buck sign around those big fields. Mm-hmm. And I love a big field. Especially if you can keep it quiet and you have it built where you don't have vehicles going by it. And then it's just a sanctuary thing. And that's what you have to do to keep those mature deer, you know, to create opportunities for you to even see them in the daylight with a bow or a gun.
Yeah. Yeah. When it comes to food plots, is there anything unique that's working particularly well down there for you, or anything that you're doing there that might be different than, you know, our great big corn and bean fields and everything that we might have up here?
You know, not really, because in the Delta portions and other portions of the state, we have a lot of corn, beans, a lot of, you know, ag production. And in those areas with that agricultural influence is where our bigger deer that weigh the most, our deer that are the biggest. There's all kind of different blends out there. Man, as much as you can get that you can, not to just pick out one thing, but if you can create something for those deer that gets them from October through May or June, which is a simple fall blend of like wheat, oats, and clover, you know, that's what I would suggest to somebody. And then you have brassicas that you can add, you know, you can keep adding to that January, February, March food source. But just the easiest is just like a simple wheat oat and clover mix, just to simplify it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what about growing conditions now, and everything?
Oh, we got, that's the thing about here, you know, our winters are not bad. So a cold front comes through and it gets, you know, down in the 20s, maybe for a couple nights, and highs in the 50s, and it might get up a little bit. It's just kind of as those fronts come in. So growing conditions are great here. We have long summers, and it gets hot, but we have a good bit of rainfall here too. I mean, I think our average rainfall is 70 something inches in a year. So it's really just all about your soil prep and your preparation, because you're never going to have a year where you can't make anything grow hardly. You just got to prepare the ground right. But speaking of food plots, and I consider this a food plot too, what I started doing on some properties I help people on. So you got a 10-acre clear cut like we discussed earlier. Well, if you go in, everybody wants to know, what do I go back and replant it with? And we used to do that. The problem with replanting in trees, whether it be pines or hardwoods or whatever, is 10 years, which is not a long time anymore, you're going to be faced with the same problem you were from day one. Those trees are going to canopy over, and you're going to start losing that understory. You follow me? You know, as they mature.
Yeah.
Well, what I started doing is taking those 10-acre blocks that you've created for bedding areas or sanctuary areas and spraying them every 3 years with a chemical, whether it be from a helicopter or do it from a ground rig, and just killing those, all the woody stuff, and letting it start over again.
So you're not selectively doing anything. You're going, kind of doing a blanket spray of everything, setting it all back.
Killing everything woody. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Do you ever burn?
What happens is, you know, we do burn in pines, and that is good. But the problem with burning is you completely clean up your area every year. So that's good for food, for turkeys and deer, yes. But when you go in there and burn, you know, all you're actually all your covered leaves. You're burning it up. So you're back to square one.
Yeah.
So I prefer to have a secluded place that I keep totally controlled and keep the grass and the dewberry and the briars and just all the stuff that deer need to survive, their main food sources, that just keeps them thick and healthy.
Yeah.
Because shade is their worst enemy.
Yeah, and to your earlier point, that kind of setup, not only does that make great cover and bedding, but when you've got all that new growth, you basically have a natural food plot too, right?
That's exactly right. And the deer got to have it, because you can plant all the stuff you want. We can. But you have to have, I mean, the natural stuff that Mother Nature put there for them, that's what they need. And if you give them plenty of that, everything else is just gravy to them, and it really works.
Yeah.
It takes a while to get that process, but it's, once you get it, it's man, does it work good.
Yeah. Speaking of natural forage, you know, when I'm walking around a property here in Michigan and I'm looking for maybe an old apple tree, or I'm looking for white oaks, I'm looking for that kind of stuff where there might be some soft mass or some hard mass, might be a natural food source I can find back in the woods and hang a stand near. But for someone down by you in Mississippi, if you can't plant food plots, but you're looking for these natural food sources that deer particularly like down by you, what are some of those things that people mm-hmm. should key in on?
Same thing you just said. I mean, of course, you got different, like early on, you're going to have all your oak species. You're going to have, we have, you know, persimmons, and we call them bean trees, which is a honey locust. And you familiar with a honey locust? It's got the long black bean on it.
Yep.
That's an important food source for the fall. And here, easy, like, we call them water oaks or pin oaks. They usually fall first. So, and that's going to be in October. And, man, when you start finding those and you walk up under that tree and you see all that deer sign and this fresh sign, old sign, you know, that's when you get excited and put that stand up around it. Whether it be persimmon. Persimmon is usually fall early October. The honey locust usually fall in October. We have another species of oak trees here. Well, I call them like a swamp chestnut or a nut all. or striped oak. It's a bigger acorn, but they usually don't fall till November, December, and even carry on into January. So it's basically the same. It's just in some of our big forests, you know, you have so many acorns that it's really hard to key in on any one tree, because there might be 100 of them in a bottom.
Would it be accurate to say that a lot of the stuff you guys are hunting down there is like big timber, like big blocks? There's not as much edge as maybe you'd see in like the ag land in Iowa or something. Is that right?
Not really. You get in the Mississippi Delta, it's a lot of big, just thousands and thousands of acres of agricultural ground with ditch roads, with little woodlots. A lot of farmers have taken their marginal ground, farm ground, and put it into CRP or WRP, which is excellent habitat.
Yeah.
I'm sure y'all have some of that too. And, you know, some of the best hunting places in Mississippi or WRP or CRP places, because when they plant that stuff, like we just talked about, you have all that natural stuff. It's thick. It holds the deer. It's plenty of food. And it gives them a place to get old.
Yeah.
That's some of the finest spots.
Yeah, can't beat that CRP and those grasses and everything. That beautiful, beautiful habitat. Deer just seem to just dive right in.
And kind of to your comment, backing up to what we talked about like the 10-acre blocks, really and truly, that's all that I'm trying to create as I explain that. Trying to create that CRP or WRP type scenario just inside a woodlot and keep it at its prime life cycle for all the plants.
Yeah. Do you have, when you're working on something like that on your own property or on a property you're helping someone out with, and you're making these little bedding area type things, do you have like a minimum size? You always try to make sure they at least are this big, or can someone go in there and, you know, they've got a chainsaw is all they have and half a day and they get a half acre or something. Is that worthwhile in your opinion? Or
absolutely. And we've done it that way too. I mean, it's not always we have big equipment and stuff to do that or the opportunities to do it, but if you can go in there with a chainsaw, I mean, a couple guys with chainsaws can knock a really good dent in some bedding habitat in a day. You know, if you can go in there and cut stuff. And another popular way is they call it hack and squirt, where you take a hatchet and you go to your local forestry store and you can get a chemical that you can actually spray, you know, cut the bark, spray it, and it'll kill that, you know, to kill that tree and stop it from shading. Yeah. There's several ways to do it, but a half acre, 1 acre, a quarter acre, any cover is better than none.
Yeah, yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah, it seems like, to your point, a tool like a chainsaw or the hack and squirt method or something, it's so much easier than most people think as far as the way you can transform an area. You can take an area that's wide open timber and turn it into just a whitetail mecca by adding that cover.
And I know one popular thing is called hinge cutting. I'm sure you're familiar with that. There's a lot of information about hinge cutting out there, and I think it's a wonderful, you know, portion of habitat to create, as well. And even if you have a small place, I just can't stress enough how important it is to give those deer cover. You know, don't ride ATVs through it. Don't walk through it. I have places that once we plant our food plots, that's the last time a gas vehicle is allowed in that section. You know, you either walk in there or you use electric. We want to keep the disturbance at a minimum at all costs after the food plots are planted, you know, in the fall and winter.
Yeah. So speaking of, you know, making these bedding areas, back to that side of things, I heard you mention a couple times you use the word sanctuary. What's your take on these sanctuary areas? When you say sanctuary, is that a place that you will never go in, or is that a place that maybe you'll hunt a few times, or how seriously do you take this quote unquote sanctuary?
Well, I wouldn't say I would never hunt there. I would not hunt there until the right time of year. And just keeping it a place where you don't disturb them. And then if I did hunt there, it would just be on the fringes, and it would just have to be the ideal conditions as far as the wind's concerned. It's just, you know, those deer will come and go from there if they're not spooked and they're comfortable. But once you start spooking them, even the old does, I mean, it's just, they live there. We're just visitors there most of the time, but that's their home. And you got to, I mean, it might sound silly, but I treat it as their home and try to respect that. So the more comfortable they are, the more fun we're going to have, you know, watching the show.
Yeah.
If you understand me.
Yeah, no, definitely. What, when you're going into your hunts, and this is admittedly, this is like an incredibly high level question. There's a thousand ways you could go with this. But you just talked about some of the things you're thinking about as far as trying to keep these deer, as unpressured as possible, make them feel comfortable, respecting their home. What other things are you doing to accomplish that? So what are some of the ways that you keep pressure low? What are some of the ways that you minimize your impact when you're going into hunt or manage a property? I think it's obviously a consistent thing between most anyone that has consistent success killing mature bucks is the fact that they are able to somehow create a situation where these deer don't realize that they're being hunted, or at least not as much as they are. How do you go about trying to do that yourself?
Well, a lot of it goes back to if you can set up your place that, you know, you can get into to stands, you can get out of stands. You know, that's your biggest impact is your movement, obviously, coming to and from places. And, you know, you just have to hunt smart. It's really not that hard, but you got to have some patience and be disciplined enough to where, hey, man, I got this acorn tree. They are killing it. I got trail cam pictures of a shooter there, but the wind's marginal. You know, if I can only hunt my best spot one time, because that's all the conditions will allow me, that's all I'm going to hunt. And I know we got, you know, Ozonic, actually, they work great. Scent control works great, but still, if you use that with that discipline of hunting your spots when only your conditions allow it, I think you'll be much more successful.
Each time.
I mean, that's just that discipline part. It's hard too. When you got those trail cameras and you got two or three nice bucks or shooter bucks, and that's all you can think about is sitting in that tree stand, man, you want to kind of push the envelope sometimes, but I don't. I never do.
Yeah. So something I like to talk to all of our different guests about is how they go about making the decision when to strike. So you've got this honey hole that you think is going to be great, but to your point, you don't want to push the envelope too much. You don't want to go too often. You don't want to go too early. What are the factors that help you decide that, yes, today's the day I need to go in? Is it a weather factor? Is it a timing factor? A combination of a whole bunch of stuff? Would love to hear about that for you.
Well, typically it's going to be weather. You know, when you got high pressure and you have fronts coming down, you have some consistent winds a lot of times, unless they're right when they first hear, and it's blowing too hard, then they kind of swirl. But here for us, if we have those low pressure days when it's not much wind blowing and it's warm and humid, and we got that southerly flow coming in, those are the worst days. Now, when you got those cool days and you walk outside and it's cool and the wind's crisp, and man, that's when I get excited, because if you think about it, the days that we hunt that it's kind of yucky, you don't see many deer those days. But the days that we hunt when it's nice and it feels good, that's when we see most of the deer, in my opinion. And so that's just let the weather dictate it. That's how I feel is so important to make your decisions on when to go. You know, don't waste a good spot on a bad day weather-wise.
Yeah. Do you give the moon any attention at all? Do you care at all about that?
You know, I do, because definitely you see some changes in movement with the moon, but, you know, hey, hunting season's short, so I'm more concerned about the weather and you know, being able to get to my spot without being detected and leave my spot than I am the moon, because they're still out there. They're going to move anytime, but if you got good weather and full moon, I think that's still a fun day versus not going.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I wouldn't take my vacation. If I had a week of vacation, I wouldn't take it during full moon in November, I can tell you that, because that can be a real slow time in the South, because our rut's in December here, where the Midwest is mostly November stuff.
Yeah. Can you walk us through that a little bit? Because everyone I've ever talked to who hunts down in the South has got a different take on how the rut operates down there, when it's really the best time to focus on. What are you seeing where you hunt as far as the timing of the rut, as far as how you approach it? Is that different at all than what you might do in Illinois or Kansas or something, how you hunt it even?
Not really. Our rut here, our peak breeding days where I hunt are the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, or either 22nd, 23rd, 24th. And the way I know that is because we've done health checks with the state on several occasions. And what they do, they shoot does and they do tests on them, and they, in February or early March, and then they can count back from the, you know, from the fetus back and know exact day that doe was bred. So that's how I got those. That's, you know, that's accurate information there. So, but you can set your clock on. I mean, some years it's more intense. Some years it's softer. And I think weather plays a little bit of a role in that here in Mississippi, because, you know, if it's 60 or 70 degrees and those deer got their coats on, it's, you know, they get hot. I think it suppresses the movement during the day, and they get a little more active at night just because of the weather. So, you know, and I know you've had hot days probably in your part of the world in November.
It's killer.
During the rut. Yeah, it's just they just don't do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I've had my best luck hunting water holes in the Midwest when it's hot during the rut, because, you know, the deer just get so heated up.
Yeah.
Chasing it.
Is there anything? One of the things I feel like, you know, when I travel out of state and I head to Illinois or Iowa or one of those states where there's just a high number of mature bucks, not quite as much hunting pressure, there's certain things that I can do during the rut that I would never do in Michigan, where there's not as many mature bucks. There's a lot more hunters. So I'll be much more aggressive. I'll use decoys. I'll do a lot of rattling and calling, different things like that. What's that like in Mississippi or Arkansas? Can you be aggressive with those types of tactics? Do those things not work as well down there? What's your take there?
I don't think decoys, I mean, decoys work here in the right conditions. We've done it, but the deer don't seem to, I don't know if it's just more of them. And so they don't, a lot of times the buck to doe ratios are not perfect here because of our density. And it's like the deer not as aggressive as they are in the Midwest. But calling, I've had great success calling here, you know, during the time of year. And I've told everybody, you have a can call and a grunt call, and if it only works, you know, twice a year, it's worth every effort to tote that thing and try it, because it doesn't spook them. So I want to have those tools in my vest every day.
Yeah.
During the pre-rut, post-rut, and rut time.
Yeah, so for you down there, what's that time frame when you would use that stuff?
Start in early December, you start getting some response the whole month, and even later in the year, because, you know, once that rut process starts and you have that triple rut later on in January, it can be effective. I think it's more important where you call from than even when you call, because if you're in this, we've talked about this, no matter what we're trying to call, whether it's turkeys, elk, or deer. If you're in a spot and you're in big open woods and you call and the buck's 100 yards and he looks and he can see where that sound's coming from, and then, I mean, but he's looking at this clear slate with nothing standing there, that typically doesn't work good. But if you're in some thick stuff or by a top or on a ridge, and that deer has, he knows where that sound's coming from, but he has to come over to investigate to see it. You know, it's just not open. That's your best scenarios.
Yeah.
Is where you call from.
That makes sense. Can you walk us through the actual call sequences or things like that? Like let's say you see a buck and he's off in the distance. Can you walk us through what kind of calls you would use first? What you would when you would stop calling or when you would start calling again or when would you switch to something else? I'd love to hear like your process there.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. So one thing we noticed early, many, many years ago is if a deer can hear a can call, and if anybody listens not familiar with a can call, it's, we call it the can. You know, Primo's makes it's just a little bleat can. It makes a little like a sound of a doe bleating. But when those deer in the seeking, looking phase, if they hear that sound, golly, they come so many times. And but it's not a loud sound. And, you know, 15 years ago, before we had the buck roar, you had a regular grunt call. If you tried to do it loud, it would kind of sound like a duck. So that's where we set out to figure out, how can we make a grunt call that's loud? So to be in more detail, so you see one at 100, 150 yards, he's not going to hear that can if he's walking in leaves. And even if he's not, he might not hear it because it's a real soft sound. But if you can grunt at him and get his attention, and then you follow that grunt with that can a time or two, then in his mind, he thinks that's a buck and a doe, or a buck chasing a doe. And she's getting close to being receptive. That's making that sound. And if you can create that scenario for a deer that's 100 to 200 yards from you and get him to hear and look your way, man, they come so many times looking.
Now, what if you do that? You do your grunt, gets his attention, do it a couple times in the can call, and he is not coming in though. He's still standing there looking around, but he hasn't committed. Do you keep going or do you stop calling now for a ways? What happens next in that scenario?
No, I stop. I stop and just give him some time and watch him, watch his mannerisms, watch his behavior. And I might, you know, if he's looking, I don't want to keep calling at him. Let him kind of, let his curiosity start working. Now, if he doesn't seem real interested, I might do, he knows you're there at that point. Then I might follow it up with a can, another can sound and maybe a grunt. And it doesn't work all the time. And if it's not working, my last resort would be with a set of rattle horns, just a real quick, like two bucks fighting over a doe, to try to get his attention. And like I said, sometimes you can try all that. And if he's not an aggressive deer, then, you know, I don't think it always works. And you got some deer that are aggressive that will run towards you every time they hear that.
Mm-hmm. I know some people, before calling, they think about the wind direction. Because sometimes these bucks will hear a call, but then want to circle downwind of that sound to kind of confirm whether or not it is what it thinks it is. Is that something you worry about at all, or have you seen that at all? Do you factor that in at all?
Not really, because I'm hunting my spot based on the scouting and the trail camera information where I think the deer are coming from and going to. And so I guess I never go hunt a spot just to call. If I do, it might be midday with rattling horns on the edge of a cutover or sanctuary type place to try to call them out of that. But you're all right. They are going to try to circle downwind. But I think I have my area figured out wind wise. So, you know, I just go with it at that point.
Gotcha. Now, do you ever, it sounds like maybe you do, because you just mentioned a scenario where I imagine you would do this, but do you ever blind call? Just head in there and...
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And with that same scenario, because I like to hunt thick stuff where I can't see 100 or 200 yards a lot of times. And so I'll do a grunt and maybe a couple grunts and then one bleat. Just, you know, maybe every 30 minutes or 45 minutes, I'll do that.
Okay.
But if deer are close to you, that's what people need to remember. If a deer's close to you, say at 50 yards, and he can key in on you where that call's coming from, you know, that's a tough one there. Sometimes you have to chance it because that might be your only opportunity to get him 10 yards closer. But, man, a lot of times that'll hang him up too.
Yeah. Do you do anything differently when you're calling in Mississippi versus if you're hunting in Iowa or some state like that?
Same thing.
Okay.
Same exact thing. Same scenario, no matter where.
Okay. All right, let's pause here for our last break of the day to thank our partners at Whitetail Properties. And producer Spencer Newharth has got another Whitetail Properties land specialist with us today to offer some advice on finding hunting properties with cash rent opportunities. This week with Whitetail Properties, we are joined by Tom James, a land specialist out of Indiana. And Tom is going to be telling us about looking at properties that advertise with cash rent opportunity.
Cash rent opportunities can mean a lot of things, and it all relates to the productivity of your soils on the tillable ground. And one thing you might want to make yourself familiar with is what's called the NCCPI rating, which stands for the National Commodity Crop Production Index. And that number usually is a range up to about 100. So you'll see NCCPI ratings of anywhere from, say, 40 or 50 on the low end, all the way up to 80s and 90s on good productive farmland. What that means, it's a good baseline to compare your productivity of your soils on a national level. So you always want to get bids on your crop ground from farmers. If you're not comfortable, you need to educate yourself on what the going rates are. I mean, sometimes a farmer's been paying historically low rent for long, long times just because he had a relationship with the previous landowner. But you want to make sure that the current rates that you could get on that property are up to date with what the standard going rates are. And those change from year to year. $150 all the way up to $300 in the past, you know, per acre on ground. So make sure you're in tune with the going rates and don't cut yourself short.
If you'd like to learn more and to see the properties that Tom currently has listed for sale, visit whitetailproperties.com/James. That's J-A-M-E-S. Something kind of jumping to a different topic than now. I saw a video of yours you were in, and you were talking about how some of your absolute favorite places to hunt are river bottoms. You love hunting the mm-hmm. river bottoms. I think you mentioned a property that was like along the Mississippi River, those types of places. Can you talk about what makes that kind of scenario unique and then how you hunt that?
You know, hunting river bottoms, and it's really not different than anything, any other places. It is flat. And so terrain, there's not a lot of terrain change. There's not a lot of funnels unless you have sloughs or some oxbow type lakes that you can catch the deer on. I guess why I like the river bottom so much is it's just where it is. It's the sounds, it's the smells. You know, the river bottoms can be tough. I mean, when the Mississippi River's up, it's mean. But if you weigh out the pros and cons of having to deal with floodwater, mainly in the springtime, you know, the benefits of that are so good to where I'm willing to deal with the high water half the year to reap the benefits of the fall and winter that it creates. But as far as being there, it's just the terrain. It's just a place I enjoy being.
Gotcha.
There's really not much else I can say other than it's just one of my favorite places to be.
Yeah. Do you ever use rivers and water like that to access locations? Is that a part of how you get in and out of places ever?
It depends. When the Mississippi River's low, we have a lot of Mississippi River frontage. So when the river's low, that's really not, you know, we don't really have that option to do that. But when the river, say if the river gets somewhat high in the wintertime, I love to hunt out of my boat. And yes, we use that to access places a lot. It's a great way to get in and out. You know, once that water starts coming up, then we start having those funnel situations that we don't have the rest of the year because they're going to follow that edge. And man, that's some fun hunting when the water gets up because you can, it makes them easier to hunt. Not only does it put them on the higher points, but it also creates more places for you to ambush them around water or crossing shallow spots or, but yeah, boat hunting is a great way to do it.
Yeah. I imagine that's something that folks could kind of use that kind of idea even when hunting maybe public land or big timber land where maybe there's not these natural funnels like you might see between a couple big cornfields and a little pinch of timber in between. That's kind of like your prototypical pinch point that everyone shows on, you know, on the Outdoor Channel or something. But would you say there's a lot of opportunities like this where maybe there's swampy ground and a high point in between or little points that extend out into water? Are those kinds of things that people could key in on maybe in scenarios where they don't have the ag field easy stuff?
Yeah. Or you could create that if you're in a situation of, you know, that just comes down to some good old scout and foot time, finding places like that in river country and flat ground. But a lot of times, if you can create a corridor, say if you cut a block of timber, say it can be 5 acres, it can be 10 acres, whatever, and I'll go in there and flag a corridor and leave a corridor right through the middle of it where they don't cut a tree. And that serves two things. It's an access point to get in and out of your stand, and it also gives you that edge effect because you know those deer love to walk those edges and scrape and rub, and the deer are going to travel those easy places as long as they're comfortable there. You know, they're going to walk out of that thick stuff and use that corridor to move up and down, as well as if you got some acorn trees in there, it just serves as a perfect place for them morning or evening to move, because it's within their sanctuary area, but it's open and they can travel to and from just like we can. It gives us an access point that's easy to get in and out. You tracking with me on that?
Oh yeah. They like that path of least resistance when they can get it.
Right. Right. And something else you can do is, Will Primos and I did this a lot. We call them sneaky rogues. So you get a clear cut, or you get a section that's thick. Anybody can do this. You don't have to create it if it's thick, but go in there and just cut you a trail through that thick stuff. And I would access it one time a year with a 6-foot bush hog and make one pass through there and never go in there again. And you cannot, and what you're doing is you're making your own deer trail. And you're making those deer come out where you want them to. But don't ever go in there, you know, unless you shoot one and you track him in there. But if you'll do that, you'd be surprised how many deer come out of that thick stuff, come out right in your food plot, come out right by your bottom where you have oak trees. I mean, you can make that scenario work wherever your spot is, and that can be in any part of the country. But just create that little deer trail, but you got to stay out of it. You can't go in there for nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, creating your own little funnels almost.
That's what it's doing. Yeah, you're just giving them a place to walk easy. Yeah. And it's not a big, you know, it's a bigger than a normal deer trail, obviously, but it's just that they're comfortable using it. It's path of least resistance, and they use it so much.
Are there any other little things you do like that on a property to manipulate or influence movement a little bit? I mean, other than we talked about making big bedding areas, we talked about making food plots, but are there any of these smaller tweaks that you add that can just kind of give your property just a little bit more of an edge for you?
You know, that's really good. That's really about what we talked about is the main nuts and bolts of it. But the cover portion is my focus. I know focus is on food, and it is extremely important. But if you got cover first in my mind, food second. You can create the cover and the places for them to be. It just can't be beat.
Yeah.
As far as numbers.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to reframe a little bit of the conversation as we go forward. I'm kind of curious about some specific examples. From a hunting standpoint, or maybe it could be habitat, but do you have, you know, if you could look back at last season, maybe, or the season before, you may want to pick a couple successful hunts where you killed a mature buck, maybe, that you remember well. Could you walk us through a couple of those where, okay, I killed buck X, it was in this scenario, and this is why it worked. Like if you could point to one or two key things for each of those successful hunts, I'd be really interested to hear how that success came about and what you think you could attribute it to. Do you have a couple of examples like that you could share with us?
Yeah, I think I have one really, really good one. So 2 years ago, I found this nut all, or striped oak as we call them, nut all tree. This is at Cottonmouth at our Primos place. And I actually shot a doe, and I was trailing that doe when I found this tree. I had no idea it was there. And it was on the edge of a slough, and they were absolutely just killing it. So I got a slough here. I got the tree, you know, 15 yards off the slough. But the problem is there was no places to put a tree stand. And I wanted to be able to, I had to hunt on a north wind up against the water. So we went in there in October and kind of tried to figure it out. We didn't want to go in there later in the year when they really got to using it because the tree wasn't dropping then. So we took a ground blind, a double bull ground blind, and set it up in there in October. And we never went back in there until December. And we snuck in one day, crossed the water. It was about knee deep, just got hip boots on, and saw the sign there. Well, the blind's there already. So I think what was key to this working was we put the blind in there, you know, early. So when the acorn started falling, the deer started coming to feed on that acorn tree, the blind was there. And of course we had it brushed in them. And so we waited till the perfect conditions got in there. I think it was like the first week of January, maybe. And Lake Pickle and I, he was running the camera that day, and we eased in there, crossed that water, got in that blind, and we wasn't there 30 minutes. And this is kind of in one of those sanctuary places. We were on the edge of it and had a 10 point come out. I shot, it was like 140 inch deer, 18 yards. He never even looked at it. He was so comfortable in that spot. So I say that, give you another scenario. We set that up, you know, 2 or 3 months before we knew we were going to hunt it. This goes back with food plots too. If you'll put a blind on a food plot the same day you plant it or just before it greens up, I mean, they never spook from it because, you know, they come out there, they expect a change. It's different. They knew something went on there, but when it starts greening up and they come out there to feed and your blind's already there, your stand or whatever, then they don't think twice about it. But if you come put a blind in there, say a month after they've been feeding there, and if you don't do an excellent job brushing it in and hiding it, a lot of times they'll pick it out. And it might take them a while to get back comfortable there. So I guess the important, my point is really, you know, think ahead on your spots and how you set them up. And, you know, those blinds are not extremely expensive. And if you can set 2 or 3 of them up in places you know you're going to use later in the year, whether it be on a food plot or on an acorn tree or whatever, pecan tree, whatever they're feeding on, apple tree, like you mentioned earlier, once that blind's there from day one, when they start feeding there, I think you're golden.
Yeah. Do you think that access route helped you out too? Because it sounds like you came through the water, so you probably avoided walking through or near that best cover. Was that something that was pretty key to that as well?
100%. Because if you think about it, you're walking into a place and you jump a deer, I mean, that can really be a domino effect in a lot of ways. One deer gets up another deer, another deer gets up another deer, and before you know it, you know, you just disrupted the whole thing. And you put them on alert, and the chances are they're not coming back that way that afternoon. So
yeah,
you definitely, you know, your routes that you get to your stand, you want it to be at least as intrusive as possible.
Yeah. You mentioned you were in there walking around. You spotted this tree, this oak tree. You were scouting, I'm assuming, in some way. I guess what am I trying to say here? When you scout a new property, or maybe even it's a property you've hunted in the past, but you're there again, is there anything you're doing or anything you're looking for specifically that's unique compared to like the cookie cutter scouting that we hear about? You know, most people walk, they look for rubs, they look for scrapes, they look for sign. Is there anything more than that you're focusing on or unique that you've picked up over the years as something important to key in on?
Yes. And I'm going to go back to pretty much, I'm a broken record on this. Cover, cover, cover. Cause if I find the cover, I'm going to find the deer. Then I can find where they go from there. I mean, I might find the biggest, prettiest oak tree in the woods that's got a ton of deer sign and put a camera on it, and you'd be like, man, they're killing this tree, but most of it's at night. Well, chances are, you know, that tree is a long way from where those deer are living. And so I want to find their home turf first. Once I figure that out, it kind of falls into place with trails and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so if you find a great patch of cover, you identify, okay, yeah, this is a home base for a doe family group or some bucks or something. What do you do from that point? Do you just identify, okay, here's cover, and you mark it mentally in your head? Or do you then dive in there and look for specific beds? Or are you trying to identify each trail that comes out of there? Or are you planning stand locations around the edges? I'm just kind of curious where your head goes after that point.
Yes, trails and edges. Never would I go in there. You know, not if I'm just traveling to a new place. Now, maybe in February or March, I would love to go in there after the season and figure out what's going on for the next year. But if it's, say, October, and like, ooh, man, this is a lot of deer sign here. I want to figure out the trails, and I want to start hunting the edges.
Yeah.
and not be too aggressive to start with. You know, if a guy only has 2 days a week to hunt, you know, he may need to be a little more aggressive because he just don't have the time. But if he's got a week to hunt or 2 weeks to hunt, you know, spend a day or two on the edges and try to figure out what's going on, and then get aggressive if your time allows for that.
Yeah. So walk me through that kind of process too. Let's say, because, you know, it seems like you travel quite a bit to hunt, and when you start on a new property, you kind of gave us a very high level there of how maybe start on the edge and work your way in. But could you give us a little more detail of what your hunting approach might be if you showed up on a new property? You've got 1 week, let's say you got 7 days to hunt it. Could you walk us through like a hypothetical of how you might start and then how that might evolve through that 7 day period?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd drive through it obviously first. And of course, with all the mapping products that are out there today, you know, you can do so much before you ever even get to that property. You can almost know that property before you even get there to hunt. And I try to identify a couple places that I think may be good for them, may be good for winds, and try to take it easy. And another thing I don't like to do is hunt in a bottom. I like to try to stay on top just because of the wind. I've had so many tough hunts where when you're down low, that wind just swirls so bad. But if you're on top of a ridge, it usually stays pretty consistent. And the way I explain this to people, if you think about a rock in a stream, so that water flowing down that stream and it goes over that rock, what does it do on the backside? It's just twisting and twirling. That's the same thing the wind does when it comes over a ridge, and it just twists over that ridge, and it's real hard to get consistent wind in a bottom. And I experience that much more in your part of the world and in the Midwest than I have here in the South. But there is some places in the South that you got to be careful too. So I keep that in mind. I'm looking for high ridges. I'm looking for cover. And, you know, many times you can just look at the trails and figure out what's going on. And if you're hunting the rut, I'm looking for the most number of does and looking for the highest concentration of deer on that property. And that's where I want to key in on. But if you only have 7 days to hunt, I mean, you really don't have a lot of time to put trail cameras out and try to find a target buck that you would if you were hunting this place all year. So, yeah, just think about the wind, the cover, and the highest concentration of deer would be my first focus.
Okay. And you mentioned cameras. In a scenario mm-hmm. like that, you might not have as much time. But what's your typical camera process? Do you use those just to identify, you know, an inventory of deer in the area? Or are you big on actually using them to try to pattern deer in some way? Or what's the way you use that tool?
I think it's a combination of both. You know, we're getting our deer using this area in daylight. Is there a mature deer here? Is he in daylight? Because, you know, you put five cameras out, most of the time you're going to have one or two bucks. You're like, man, them deer are coming out here in daylight. And these other spots, I'm not getting any pictures except, you know, in the dark. And I think that again refers back to where you're getting close to their home turf. And if I can get as close to where they're living without disturbing them, I think you're money ahead every time, because if they move late in the evenings, you know, I want to be as close as I can be to them without intruding on them, because they might not move to that destination field that's a half mile from where they sleep or a quarter mile from where they sleep and not get there till dark. So if I can get as close to that as possible, if I can identify where that deer is in the daylight, then that's where I want to try to be.
Yeah.
To catch that daylight movement. Now, during the rut, they might be on their feet all day.
Yeah.
I'm kind of referring to early season or a little pre-rut stuff, actually.
Yeah. What kind of places do you like to set your cameras up on to learn some of this stuff?
You know, it just depends. Usually a food source is a good source, the edge of a field, catching those deer. And if you can create those little sneaky roads I mentioned earlier, or those corridors, or you do have a funnel at the end of a lake where they're crossing at the end of a slough, a natural corridor. I mean, I try to just put them in places like that, just where I think, you know, where deer move frequently.
Yeah, yeah.
Mainly food, I guess, is what we all focus on, probably. Okay.
So, I feel like we need to wrap this one up here in a little bit. I don't want to keep you too long, Brad. But I've got a couple more questions here that are a little bit different direction. But if you were to have like your best hunting buddies sit down here with us, if you and your best hunting buddies and we are all sitting down here talking about deer, if I were to ask them what it is that Brad does best, or what makes Brad a successful deer hunter, if you had to guess what your best hunting buddies would say about you, what you think they would point a finger at, what do you think they would point to as your kind of unique superpower or whatever it might be that makes it work for you?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not good at talking about myself.
Well, this is your buddies. Your buddies are talking about you, Brad.
I don't know. If my buddy, they would probably say stuff that I couldn't say right here. You know how buddies do, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you're a true buddy, you can say anything to your buddy.
Uh-huh.
And we give each other a hard time. But I guess probably one thing that I'm probably most proud of is just being able to anticipation, like we've been talking about, create that spot, scout, spend plenty of time scouting after the season, February, March. I'm usually the only one scouting our place in. Everybody else is tired of hunting. And that's when I find out probably the most information that I store away for the next year. But I think anticipating, being able to figure out and be patient about it is I think one thing that helps me the most.
Yeah. That seems to be, if there's any one thing I could point to that across 99% of the people I've talked to, talked to most of the best deer hunters across the entire country over the last 4 years, almost every one of them can point to that as a key thing they focus on is scouting. Scouting, scouting, scouting. Yeah. Really focusing on learning your property, learning these deer. A lot of people prioritize scouting over actually hunting in many cases. That doesn't surprise me. That's something that you do well. Now,
one motto I have that I live by hunting wise is I'd rather spend a little time in a good place than a lot of time in a bad place.
Yeah.
And I always know there's a better place.
Yeah.
Now I might not be able to go find it this hunting season, but I'm going to figure it out after the season, and I'm gonna be ready for that the next year.
Yeah.
So you got to be able to do that, and it doesn't work for everybody based on their time and what they do. And you might have to get a little more aggressive, but man, if you can. But hey, how much fun is it to? That's what I like about deer so much is it's turned into a year round, almost a year round sport for us.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you know, and that's what I think that's what all us deer hunters share in common is. It is a year-round sport. We're thinking about it. We're finding sheds. We're scouting in February, March. Getting our summer stuff ready in May and June, and start putting cameras out in July, seeing how big the bucks are going to be this year. Who doesn't love that? Getting their first buck pictures of the year. I mean,
it's Christmas morning right there.
It is. We're like a bunch of kids.
Yep.
And it's just love. I'm like I said, I'm going to my camp. Spend next week there on a dozer, doing some plots that I figured out last winter that I had to wait till I could create them to do some changing of them now. And then we got vetch planted in soybeans and we got cameras out on some mineral licks. So yeah, I got a fun week. It's just like, it's much fun. It's like opening the week for me.
Yeah.
In a sense.
The process, the projects and the process are
the process, man. We love it. And I think some of the best hunters I know, they've never even seen them on TV. None of us have, because they are just good, hardworking, love to hunt, and they're private. But their biggest thing is they spend the time figuring stuff out.
Yeah, yeah.
They spend way more time figuring out where that tree is than they do just sitting in that tree.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about this? If we're in that same room with your buddies again, and I ask them, what does Brad do that you think is just crazy? If there's something you do that everyone else thinks is bizarre, but you say, no, man, this works, or I'm going to do this every year because I just have seen it work, or something like that, but everyone else thinks you're kind of weird because you do it. Is there anything like that that you can think of that they'd call out?
Yeah, I don't hunt mornings.
At all?
Except during the rut. That's it.
Explain that.
Because, what I believe is, you know, you find all these good places. Well, when you walk in there, the deer are going to be mostly on their feet at night, the mature deer. And you walk in there to that spot, so you got this acorn tree or whatever you're hunting, or this food plot you create, and you walk in there and you spook them deer out of there. Well, who knows where they're going to end up bedding? They might end up 200 or 300 yards further away from this spot than they normally would. Well, they're not going to get there till that afternoon, till dark. And I feel like a lot of times I'm changing my afternoon chances if I hunt mornings in some good places, because the risk of spooking stuff is so much better getting in there before daylight or right at daylight than it is, you know, at 2 in the afternoon when everybody's asleep and comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So I just stay out of the woods in the mornings until rut time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because then everything changes then.
Yeah. I've seen a similar thing too. Early season and late season, it seems like those morning hunts are low chances of success, high chances of risk of screwing things up. While those afternoon hunts are low chance of spooking things when you go in there, but high chances for an opportunity. So the odds are much more in your favor for those evening hunts. And if you don't screw it up in the morning, it's that much better.
That's right. Yep. So I'll take it easy and shoot my bow, or go look at a new place, or go squirrel hunting if it's early season. I mean, I enjoy squirrel hunting as much as anything, and you know, there's still plenty to do in the outdoors. And I just, man, I'm careful with my good spots.
Yeah.
So,
final question, and you kind of you already answered this a little bit, so you feel free to go back on your first answer or give me something different. But you've spent time around a lot of great deer hunters, some of the very best out there, mm-hmm. whether it be the Primos crew or other folks with whitetail properties or just friends of ours or friends of yours that we've never heard of. But if you were to look at all the very best deer hunters you know, and if you could then circle what they all have in common, is there anything that you could point to as like, this is that core common, maybe it's a habit or an attitude or a tactic that they all seem to have in common? What would that be?
Well, you know, like we said, anticipation and being able to figure where that deer is going to be is number one. Secondly, is patience. You know, another thing, and I don't do it, but I know guys that, you know, they'll go get in a tree at 9 or 10 in the morning and stay there the whole day. And they have, those are the guys I look up to. They have the patience to sit there, and I have before, and I will again, but it's just not something. I enjoy the camp life. I'd rather hang around with my family and friends and laugh than hunt the afternoon. But yeah, anticipation and patience.
Yeah.
But knowing when to use those patience. Don't go sit in the spot thinking you might get lucky. If you're in that spot and the conditions aren't right.
Yeah.
Like I said, it goes back to spend a little time in a good spot, and way better than a lot of time in a bad spot.
Yeah, that's a great little reminder just to keep in the back of your head during the season. There's a lot of times where it's easy to, you know, I think something that I've been guilty of in the past, and I think a lot of other people have talked about, where you can sometimes get comfortable where, oh, well, I've already got a mm-hmm. stand here. I don't really want to tear down this stand or go grab a new stand and hang it up in a new spot. Or I don't really want, it'd be kind of inconvenient to have to go walk around to find this new area, or to maybe I saw a mature buck moving a couple times over 300 yards away. But to your point, just always remind yourself, a little bit of time in the best spot, in the right spot, is so much more valuable than being comfortable and lazy in the spot that's already set up, but not as good.
Yep, and I always have a, you know, if you have a ground blind and a climbing stand, and obviously we have our regular hang-on sets, if you have those, it's pretty much not much a scenario you can't figure out. But I love a climbing stand for what you just said. You know, so you got your spot set up, and based on your scouting efforts, and you were a little bit off, a little wrong, and or the deer not where I thought they'd be there, 100 yards over there. Well, I'll try that if the conditions are right, but I'll take a climber in there. You know, early afternoon, 1 or 2 o'clock, ease in there, climb a tree and see how that goes. But what I also believe that I never do is leave a climber in there overnight, because you've been touching it, you've been sitting on it, and you might as well just leave your shirt hanging there. So I always take that climber back off the tree and ease out of there. And you know, I found good spots that way. And then you just learn year after year where you need to kind of refocus. But yeah, climbers are good. Just don't leave them in there overnight if you're in a hot spot.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like you see a lot of guys who will just leave them connected at the bottom of the tree if they're going to go back in there. Mm-hmm. But to your point, that's just a huge scent bomb probably.
It is, just sitting there. You might as well just sit there all night. Yeah.
Man, well, Brett, I've really enjoyed this. I appreciate you taking the time to talk through all these different ideas and stories and everything. And if people want to see what you've got going on with Primos, or if they want to learn more about what you're doing with Whitetail Properties or anything like that, you know, where can they find that stuff online?
Well, of course, the Primos. You got the Primos.com is where they have all the Primos stuff, and we do a lot of stuff on Primos on the YouTube. On the YouTube channel they have too, as far as tips and tactics and basically a lot of the same stuff all us guys do about what you and I've been discussing today. And then, you know, as far as Whitetail Properties goes, if you go to whitetailproperties.com and go to my page, you can see all the listings that I have there. And we have a lot of good stuff on with all things to do with land on there too, with our Land Beat series. On people can learn a lot of the same things we've been discussing. The video team there at Whitetail Properties has created some great short clips on how to do land stuff, like, you know, hinge cutting and all that, management practices.
Yeah, so. I've been following that video series, and they're definitely doing a good job. And same with Primos. Mm-hmm. I've really enjoyed the YouTube channel that you guys have been putting together there, and a lot of quality stuff. So highly recommend people checking out both of those.
Well, thank you. Well, it's definitely been a fun time visiting with you, and kind of got me thinking, man, I'm that much more ready to go check out some of my stuff I'm looking forward to next week.
Yeah, me too. I think as soon as we get off the line here, I'm going to head out and do some spraying of food plots, hang a couple cameras, and just get right to it.
Well, nice. Well, good deal. We'll be safe out there, and I hope you have a wonderful and successful fall.
Yeah, same to you, Brad. Thanks so much. And that is it for today's episode. So, just my usual reminder, if you haven't left a rating or review for the podcast on iTunes, would appreciate that. Make sure you're subscribed there as well. Also, make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow me on the Wired to Hunt Instagram account. A lot of fun stuff coming up in September once my hunting season kicks off. So check that out. And most importantly, just want to thank you all for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing this time with me today. Maybe you were on the treadmill or driving to work or at work, whatever it might be. We appreciate you tuning in. So until next time, thanks and stay wired to hunt.
Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate Batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate Batteries. I use Interstate Batteries in my boats. I use Interstate Batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.